I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
In this episode of The Trade Guys, we discuss the Biden administration's recent WRO on polysilicon. We also discuss Trade Promotion Authority and what its pending expiration means for upcoming trade agreement negotiations. Plus, we discuss the moratorium on e-commerce negotiations at the WTO and the results of the recent trade monitoring report. Stay tuned for all that and more on this episode of The Trade Guys. Good afternoon, Trade Guys, and hello to the audience. We have a brief update to our summer schedule. Scott, would you like to share?
Thanks, Jasmine. Yes, beginning with next week's episode, we'll move to a bi-weekly schedule. So you'll hear from us instead of a weekly podcast, you'll hear from us every other week. Because as much as Bill and I think of ourselves as different from Washington, we're both Washington creatures, and the place, for lots of reasons, slows down in the summer. We're going to take that opportunity and give you about half as many podcasts as you're used to getting, but we'll hope to make sure there's plenty of quality to make up for the lack of quantity.
And I can hear the sighs of relief from everybody. Thank God we don't have to listen to them as often as we used to have to listen to them.
But thank you for subscribing. We appreciate all of you who do listen regularly, and we'll be back to a weekly schedule before you know it.
Great, thanks. Today, I thought we'd start off with an update to the solar panels and polysilicon issue we talked about last week. The Biden administration has put five companies that make polysilicon on the Commerce Department's entity list, which requires U.S. companies to get a license to export to them. It also banned imports of solar products made by a polysilicon manufacturer in Xinjiang. What are your takes on this latest development?
I'm not surprised that they followed up. They said they were going to do it. It's something that can be done. What's interesting to me, first two things. First, that it turns out the U.S. government's on both ends of a solar panel transaction these days. So we have restrictions on the parts of the supply chain of an imported solar panel, which the CBP will manage. And then on the consumer end of it, there are still tax credits for installing solar panels. So it's a cradle-to-grave government program, as it turns out. The fact that they have pursued this makes sense given the human rights component of President Biden's international economic strategy and policy. So that all makes sense. I think the first thing that it will drive is a much greater degree of transparency in supply chains for importers of solar panels. So if you're importing them, you're going to need to be able to demonstrate that the polysilicon used in the making of that panel is not produced in the affected plant. Having said that, this is one where our friend Gary Huffbauer used to think about sanctions as whether they're feeling good or looking good, or actually doing good. So these I think will feel good. I'm not sure they'll do much to affect the forced labor situation, mostly because of the size of the domestic market for solar panels in China. There's about three times as many installed panels in China. It's a larger consumption market for solar panels. And so what you're likely to have are the sanctioned polysilicon firms are going to supply the domestic market, and the non-sanctioned one will wind up supplying the export market. And no producer in China will notice the difference. That's at least what it looks like at a top-line basis. We'll find out once it's implemented.
I think what was noteworthy about it was that they did not do a blanket ban on imports. They did a targeted ban on specific companies, which is much narrower. I mean, they always have the option of expanding it. But it allows the Chinese to do exactly what Scott just said, which is send the banned panels to other countries that have not taken a similar action and send to the United States the items that have not subject to the ban. Although I don't think the question here is panels. I think it's some of the ingredients that go into it.
Right. It's the material that's used to make the solar cells. So it's a supply chain issue. And the materials are made in specific locations. It's a chemical process.
It is. I did my column this week on sanctions, although I used Myanmar as an example, and not this case. And there's some important differences, but it's a reminder that one of the things that you always have to do or should do is to figure out why you're doing it. If it's feel good or do good or actually will have an impact. And then you have to figure out, as I put it in the column, whether the juice is worth the squeeze. You know, these things always have downstream effects or collateral damage, as you might say. You know, in the Myanmar case, while we were sanctioning companies that were owned by the military leaders or run by the military leaders, or in some cases, their children, at the same time, the reality was those companies employed a lot of poor Myanmar women making various things, and men for that matter, and a lot of miners. A lot of the Myanmar sanctions were on the gemstone industry. And so if they lose their jobs, then basically what we have done is to hurt the innocent in our effort to go after the guilty. And I think one of my complaints for 30 years has been that we don't always think through the consequences of that. It may be that in that case, what the Myanmar military is doing is so horrible that, you know, the juice is worth a squeeze, but we shouldn't pretend that there's no squeeze and that something bad is happening. In the China case, I think it's different because this is about forced labor. It's not about, you know, poor people necessarily losing their jobs. It's about people being forced to do something that they probably don't want to do anyway. So the collateral damage is a little bit different. But the other difference, though, is that as long as we're the only one taking this action, it's relatively easy for them to get around it, which makes it all the more important for Biden, the multilateralist supreme, to spend some time enlisting other buying countries, importing countries, to take the same action.
The Trump administration initially banned certain companies in Xinjiang involved in cotton and tomato supply chains before implementing a Xinjiang-wide ban. Is it likely that the Biden administration will now consider a region-wide withhold release order?
I do. Yeah, I think it will come to that. But they appear to want to proceed piece by piece for the time being.
It would be useful to look and see whether the Trump approach in cotton and tomatoes actually made any difference. I'm not sure it did. Once again, you're dealing with a country, in this case, the People's Republic of China, that's got a monstrously large home market. And so it's very hard to push on imports and expect to disrupt the total production change because of the domestic consumption that is unaffected by the export market. So it's one of these things, a very difficult thing to try to create real influence or real pressure in this situation because of the size and importance of the home market in China. So we'll have to watch and see if this does any good.
Turning now to another issue Biden is grappling with, trade promotion authority. The 2015 TPA bill officially expires tomorrow, and there hasn't been any movement to renew the legislation. Could you both explain what TPA is and the arguments in support of and against the renewal of the legislation?
Well, it doesn't appear as so much as they're grappling with it as they're waving goodbye. In fact, this expired 3 months ago. The way Trade Promotion Authority works, TPA, is basically an agreement between the Congress and the executive about how to handle trade agreements. Because our Constitution divides the power for trade agreements, the Congress has the power in Article 1 to regulate commerce with foreign nations. The president has the power in Article 2 to make treaties with foreign nations. And trade agreements tend to be a little of both. So Trade Promotion Authority is the current way the Congress and the executive agree on what the priorities are and then agree on the treatment of how an agreement is treated by the House and Senate once it's negotiated by the executive. It tends to be episodic, at least in recent times. It's always a big political fight to get it approved. They tried in 1997. There was a bill that was reported out of the Senate Finance Committee. This is President Bill Clinton. And at that time, I'm pretty sure it was a Republican majority in both House and Senate. The Senate Finance Committee reported out a bill, I think 19-2. It was a pretty bipartisan product, but it failed to advance in the House, and the authority lapsed again. The Bush administration tried it in early in President George W. Bush's term 2001, 2002. It was a bitter battle. The House passed it by one vote. The conference report was a landslide of a three-vote passage in the House, but had the additional drama of a Republican chairman refusing to sign the conference report. It required a personal intervention by the President Bush to get the report signed. It was hair-raising. So, and once again, that authority lapsed in 2009, and then was renewed again in 2015, again, fairly bitter dispute. And the 2015 authority was really only used for the revisions to NAFTA called USMCA. And it's now this is expiring. So one of the observations I'd make is I think the political diminishing returns have set in with TPA. It's always a draining, intense debate in the Congress. And then the recriminations go on from the debate. And in this case, we didn't really use it for much, despite having it for 6 years. So I don't know what comes next. Bill, you probably thought about this a lot.
Let me begin with a little bit about what it does. And there's history here. You know, under the Constitution, as Scott described, Congress used to make trade policy pretty much on its own. In fact, they would actually set tariff limits line by line. That's how we got Smoot-Hawley. That's how we got Ford v. McCumber before Smoot-Hawley and high tariffs. When Roosevelt came in the midst of the Depression, when things obviously weren't working right, he and the Congress agreed on a different approach, which was essentially to divide the trade policy process into three parts. The first part was Congress would control the first and the third part, and the parts of the administration, the second one. In the first part, Congress would set the negotiating objectives. They would tell the president, here is what we want you to negotiate. The second part was the president would then go out and do that. And then the third part was that he would come back, bring the agreement back, and Congress would have to approve it. So Congress was at the front end and the back end, but the heavy lifting of the actual negotiation was handed over to the president. That was refined in 1974, in the 74 Trade Act, when there was a concern that arose that Congress might essentially try to disassemble an agreement that had been negotiated, that is, to approve part of it and not the other part. And when you had a multilateral negotiation, of course, that would result in the whole thing falling apart because you can't have countries that have negotiated in good faith and then have one country turn around and say, well, we're going to accept these 47 parts. We're going to reject these 15 parts. So the deal that was made then, and that was President Ford who signed it, was that the Congress would provide the objectives. The president would send the process back. And Congress had to approve it, but in a bow to what I just described, the Congress agreed that they would act on the entire agreement as a whole. So no amendments were permitted, and debate was limited. So there could be no holds, no filibusters. There were times specified that, you know, if the committee didn't act, it would be discharged, the bills would get to the floor. So basically, the president was guaranteed an up or down vote on what he negotiated. If it went down, of course, then they would have to go back and, you know, start over again. But that was the way it worked. And it became more controversial over time, I think, for several reasons. One, I think trust in the Clinton administration, unfortunately, I think trust between the branches of government broke down. And some elements of the trade community, particularly organized labor, began to take not only an increasingly skeptical view toward trade, which they'd had really since the 70s, but began to make it a much higher priority in terms of their lobbying activity, which made it a sensitive issue for Democrats. And then, of course, it put Democratic presidents seeking the authority in a complicated position because it had him, Clinton or Obama, for that matter, bringing up issues, an issue that divided his party, which the Republicans always enjoyed. I think that it's not past its prime, because the reality is that the president needs the authority to get anything done in the trade business. Now, right now, we don't have an administration that seems to want to negotiate anything. So it's sort of moot. But, you know, editorial here, I think this is a major fail by the Biden administration. And it's playing out exactly the same way that it played out in the Obama administration. The authority had expired before Obama came in. those of us in the business community at the time came to the administration and said, you need to get this now. You've got majorities in both bodies in 2009. You haven't irritated anybody yet. This was February and March. Get it while you can, because you're going to need it. And their response was, no, we're doing healthcare. We have to save all our political capital for healthcare. So 5 years later, they got around to it, which was really too late, because in the end, the previous bill, even though it had expired, applied to negotiations that had been concluded prior to the expiration, even though they had not been submitted to Congress. And Korea and a couple others fell into that category. But the only new one that came up was TPP. And that was so late, you know, that they couldn't get it done in Obama's term. And then Trump, of course, withdrew. But what's going to happen, you can see it. Virtually every conversation that Biden has with foreign leaders, they bring up trade. You know, it may or may not be on his screen, but it's on their screen, beginning with the UK and Kenya and Japan. And when he goes to Asia, as he probably will this fall for one of the various summits that occurs, or the G20 at the end of October, that's what they're going to be talking about. And he's going to reach the point where he's going to want to negotiate something. If you listen to Ambassador Tai, she's talking about we need to upgrade the labor provisions. We need to upgrade the environment provisions. She doesn't talk about market access, which is another story. But, you know, if you want to upgrade labor and environment, you have to have a negotiation to do it. And if you want to have a negotiation to do it, you want to have this authority. Because if you don't have this authority, you can negotiate anyway. But then you bring the bill back and it's subject to ordinary procedures, which means a filibuster in the Senate. And in a Senate that's divided 50-50, that's very, very likely. So I think they'll come to regret their failure to do anything about it in the first 6 months.
You know, it's one of these things. There's no doubt it would be difficult. It would take a lot of political capital. You can't, on one hand, say that this job's really hard and we don't want to invest the political capital in doing it. And on the other hand, complain about the loss of American leadership abroad, because there's nothing like getting the Congress and the president on the same page regarding key international economic issues than as the basis for American leadership. And so, look, I'm for that. I think there's been a vacuum abroad. But I've noticed over the years, when negotiating authority has expired or is not available to the president, there's less of a role for the U.S. leadership. You can have less of an impact because you're not ready to act. And so I'm with Bill. I think that it's an opportunity they should not postpone action on for much longer. And it may be a totally different coalition of people and interests that form the majority in this case. You know, with the last couple of reauthorizations of TPA, it's been sort of the Chamber of Commerce and the big business associations getting Republicans to vote for the thing and getting enough Democrats to pass. It could be an entirely different coalition, but you've got to go build that. You've got to go build it from the middle out and have it reflect the issues that are really important to the Congress. So I hope they do it. I'm not sure they will.
It will need to be bipartisan, because that's, I think, on a trade issue, that's the bill that's the only way to pass it. One of my complaints about the Democrats, and I can say this because I am one, but one of my complaints about them in recent years on trade is they spend an awful lot of time, you know, catering to elements of their party that are never going to support this anyway. And when I was representing companies, this was the constant complaint of the companies. They said, we're the ones that are going to do the heavy lifting to get these bills through. And if you want to get Korea passed, if you want to get any of these agreements passed, you're going to need business enthusiasm, not just support, but enthusiasm. And if you spend all your time talking to organized labor, which in all likelihood isn't going to support the bill anyway, you know, this is not a recipe for success. Now, USMCA was an exception, and it'll be interesting to see if that turns out to be a change, which is what Scott is implying, that they can put together that same kind of coalition going forward. I wish them well. I hope they can. We'll see if that was one off, or if that's a sign of the future.
The Biden administration has shown little interest in pursuing FTAs with the United Kingdom and Kenya, and also at the WTO with the EGA and Trade and Services Agreement. How will the expiration of TPA legislation affect those?
Well, look, I don't see any way to make progress on a comprehensive free trade agreement, particularly one that's with a partner like the United Kingdom, where it's going to be a lot of complicated issues. Their agriculture trade is going to be an important element. I don't know how you do that without the negotiating authority. And so it appears that their priorities are elsewhere. I would note that the Congress at this point is a lot more interested in getting chief ag negotiator, agricultural negotiator appointed than they are in getting a WTO ambassador. We have the deputy chief of mission in charge in Geneva. David Bisbee's, he's a good guy, but he doesn't have the rank of ambassador. He's not, doesn't have the deputy USTR rank. That person who is our permanent representative to the WTO generally has. The Congress is signaling their interest in other things, as is the Biden administration. So I'm not hopeful that any of this is going to resolve soon.
Well, and it has short-term consequences. If there's a successful WTO ministerial in November, there's going to be a fisheries agreement. Well, that means the United States is going to have to come back with a fisheries agreement, and they're going to ask Congress to approve it, assuming there's something in there that affects U.S. law, which I think there probably will be. And so I guarantee you fisheries is not non-controversial, and there's a lot of fishery interest in the United States, particularly in the coastal states, where there's a lot of fishermen. People are going to have amendments, and it's a legitimate question at the ministerial to ask the United States, you know, what steps have you taken to make sure that whatever is agreed to is going to get approved? And right now, they don't have any answer to that.
Speaking of the WTO, we have two last topics for today. And let's first discuss the upcoming WTO ministerial in November. One of the biggest priorities on the table is a moratorium on the e-commerce agreement. Could you guys explain what the e-commerce agreement is designed to accomplish and what the arguments for and against creating a moratorium for it are?
Well, it's an old issue. It comes up every ministerial because the moratorium has a limited lifespan, and it expires every couple of years, and so it comes up at the moratorium. I don't know the original history of it. What it is, it says, is you can't put a tax on digital transactions. And the United States, as a leader in the digital transaction space for a long time, has supported the moratorium as a means of promoting more digital growth. To the extent that countries are against it, I think there's two reasons why there's against it. First of all, there's some countries that want the money. You know, it's a potential revenue source, and they're thinking, you know, why can't we tax that? It'll help our budget out. I think for the larger argument has been that it's become a pawn, if you will, in a separate struggle, because there's another temporary rule that also lapses at the same time. And that's the ban or the moratorium against filing what are known as non-violation complaints. I can attempt to explain that, but Scott, do you want to explain it or do you want me to go ahead and do it?
You're on a roll, so go ahead. I will note that you've got the history of the moratorium on e-commerce tariffs, right? It goes back to the very infancy of trade on the internet. I think the Singapore ministerial in 1997, roughly speaking, was the time that it was the moratorium on digital tariffs, basically tariffs on electronic commerce, was made. And of course, digital commerce was in its very infancy then. It's gotten big, so it's become a bigger bargaining chip. But Bill, go ahead on the part two of this frequent horse trading topic.
Most trade complaints in the WTO are brought against countries alleging that they have violated some specific article of the WTO. There's a rule and they broke it. And the rule's identified, and then the dispute settlement process is to review what the country did and make a judgment as to whether they've actually broken the rule. There is also, however, another category called non-violation complaints, which is basically when a country alleges not a violation of a specific article, but alleges that the actions of the other country have disadvantaged or have reduced or compromised the benefits that the complaining country is entitled to as a member of the WTO. That's referred to as a non-violation complaint because you're not alleging a specific breaking of the rule. You're alleging actions that undermine the rights and obligations that our country is entitled to. And countries that do that, India being the primary example, have wanted to prohibit those kinds of complaints from being brought, which is self-interest because they know who they'll be brought against and they're the prime target. So that moratorium was also agreed to. And they've been linked really ever since because they both expire at the same time. And it's become kind of a set piece. the Indians come in and say, we want the internet tax moratorium to expire because we want to tax that revenue. And the Americans say, well, then we want the moratorium on non-violation cases to expire so we can file some against you. And then that argument goes on for about a year. And they both agree, then everybody agrees to continue both moratoria. That's coming up in November. Those issues will be fought out. We'll see if the same thing happens again or not. The United States in the past has been very clear that in linking the two and in saying that if people are going to object to the internet tax moratorium extension, then we are going to object to the other one.
What will be some of the biggest challenges during e-commerce negotiations? Is it likely for issues concerning cross-border data flows and data localization to reach a consensus?
Well, one of the problems with the WTO's current operations is that when it comes to digital trade and electronic commerce, it's still 1997 for practical purposes. The agreements have not been updated. They have not stayed current with the way the technology has changed, with adaptations that have been made. And so while there are some models of very strong cross-border data flow agreements, none of those are WTO agreements. Settling this or extending this moratorium is probably a good thing to do and probably will get done because it's gotten done in the past. But there is a disconnect from reality, or at least the disconnect from the passage of time, that is evident in this. And so internet governance is really happening someplace else to the extent that it's happening at all.
Last topic for today, results from the WTO trade monitoring report were released yesterday. Generally speaking, the results show that trade policy restraint by WTO members prevented a, quote, destructive acceleration of protectionist trade measures that would have further hurt the world economy, end quote. The report also indicates that trade was a force for good, especially during the pandemic, by enabling access to medical supplies. What are your reactions to the results?
That is what we used to call spin, and I think still do call spin. That's putting a very smiley-faced look on a tough situation. There were a lot of actions that were contrary to market forces working and contrary, ultimately, to the principles of open trade and the commitments countries made when the pandemic struck. There were immediate export bans or export restrictions put in place by a number of countries, despite the fact that nobody made everything when it came to medical equipment and personal protective equipment and all the materials needed to fight the pandemic. The report basically concludes, well, it could have been worse. And it's, believe me, it could have been worse. The habits of cooperation were not evident among trade ministries and among the institutions of the trading system, like, most importantly, the WTO. It's not that they didn't try. It's that if you want to see cooperation on an international basis, look at what the central banks did, okay? And to a partial extent, the finance ministries worldwide. There was excellent coordination to preserve liquidity and do the kinds of things that absorbed some of the economic shocks associated with the pandemic. But a lot of bad trade practices came in. You know, borders came back to life from a good standpoint within Europe, which was supposed to have been a single market. So, and it's not all laid at the feet of the WTO. But the report is much happier than I seem to recall the situation. And, it's always possible to make the case things could have been worse. There's a legitimacy question that gets raised when you look at the actual pattern of events. So nice try, but didn't sell with me.
Well, thanks Bill and Scott for another great conversation today. A lot of the issues we'll have to keep following, and I'm sure there will be more updates. To our audience, thanks for listening, and we will be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to the Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.